Hello and welcome to the Haaretz podcast. I'm Allison Kaplan Summer in Tel Aviv. Today I am pleased to welcome my colleague at Haaretz, Shireen Falach Saab, in the first of a series of three special episodes of the podcast in coming months. In these three Ask Them Anything episodes, journalists at Haaretz will respond to questions that our subscribers have sent in so they can share their expertise and address exactly what people want to know. Subscribers from around the world responded to our request for questions, and so it's really exciting to be able to answer them now. Shireen, thank you for being my first colleague to participate in this new adventure.
Thank you, Allison, for inviting me again. It's my pleasure.
So the tremendous response to our offer for subscribers to ask you anything shows how much interest there is both in your coverage and in you. So before we get to the questions, let's begin by learning a little bit about you, who you are, where you live, how you came to write for Haaretz, and how you see your job and your role.
I would like to share the subscribers that this is the first time I'm sharing my story, and it's my pleasure to share them my story. I came from the Druze community, and it's a small community that lives in Lebanon, Syria, and also here in Israel. My grandfather from my mother's side is Syrian, who was born in Damascus and lived most of his life in Majdal Shams in Golan, also occupied the territory. And after the ceasefire agreement with Syria, almost all the Golan Heights still in Israeli hands. So my starting point is very complicated. As a child, I experienced the meaning of boundaries myself in the 80s and 90s. Syrians in the Golan, including my grandfather, came to the border area every week to talk to their relatives across the border using the megaphone. It's a childhood memory that combines me until this day. I live in Abu Sinan, a small village in the Galil, and my father is also from a small village in the Galil, Kfar Samia. And all his life, he believed that the right way to live in Israel is also to integrate into Israeli society. And this is why he wanted me to integrate into Israeli society, including studying with Jews at school. So definitely it was not easy for me as a kid because I didn't speak the Hebrew language. And I have to explain every time for Jews who I am and where I came from. And you know, Allison, Israeli society does not always accept diversity. And it's the first challenges as a kid. My parents raised me to believe in peace and coexistence with Jews. The day that Rabin was murdered, I was there with my parents. He sang the song of peace. I was 7 years old, and somehow since childhood, I have lived the conflicts, all the conflicts of Israel. And this is also the reason that I choose to write in Hebrew language, because I really want to bridge the gaps between Arabs and Jews by telling our stories and the everyday life struggling.
How did you come to write for Haaretz?
I started working at Haaretz in 2021. Noah Landau launched the Haaretz 21, an initiative by Haaretz aimed to amplifying underrepresented voices of Arab-Palestinian communities within Israel. And since then, Haaretz has been my home. Before that, I used to write a blog in Haaretz in Hebrew, about everyday life as an Arab woman, also mother of two daughters, and as a minority that I'm trying to find my way in Israel. I covered before also the cultural affairs in the Arab world for Haaretz, a subject that is very close to my heart, but you know, everything in Israel, wars are embedded in our everyday life. So the attack on Gaza in 2021, I began also to cover the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
And how did the war now, this time around, October 7th, afterwards change your role? Do you feel like your job is very different after October 7th than it was before?
when I started to covering a Gaza humanitarian situation, I asked a simple question: how can Gazans deal with another military operation when the health system in Gaza is so weak? You know, it was a period of time that the whole region started to recover from the coronavirus pandemic. And I have a great personal interest in Gaza medical system as a part of my passion for subject of healthcare. Many of you probably don't know that I also hold a degree in physical therapy with specialization in health promotion. So I view Gaza not just as a journalist, but also someone who knows how important the public health issues are to the population. And the Gaza health system has been collapsed since 2021. And now in the current war, the situation is catastrophic. And it's very hard to me also to cover the stories.
So without further ado, let's turn to our subscribers' questions. Our first question comes from a woman named Isabel Greenberg in Antwerp, Belgium. She asks something that we actually heard from several subscribers. There seems to be a great deal of interest in this, even though it's pretty much a question about language. The issue of what non-Jewish Israelis, Muslim and Christian Arabs, and presumably additionally in the Druze community, prefer to be called.
Hello, this is Isabel from Antwerp, Belgium. I was wondering, actually, how Palestinians with Israeli nationality prefer to be designated. Palestinian Israelis, Israeli Palestinians, Arab Israeli, Israeli Arabs.
This is a huge question about the politics of Arabs' identity in Israel. And I think it's very difficult to understand for those who are not deeply familiar with the history of the Middle East and the history of the Palestinians and the Arabs who lived in Israel. And I would like to connect this for the history. Before, in 1948, Arabs and Jews lived here together, and some of the Palestinians during the Nakba, they just evacuate from their villages, and the Arab world called them the Arab refugees, and later they called them Palestinian refugees. And today there are about 5 million refugees, and some of them live in Lebanon, Jordan, and they're also internal refugees who live within the borders of Israel who were displaced from their villages. For example, in Nazareth, there are refugees from Safuria village. It's a Palestinian village. There is a Palestinian poet. His name, Taha Muhammad Ali. He wrote poetry about his experience of displacement as a child. And he lived in Safuria, and he displaced with his family. And I'm telling this story to bring you an example. Why some people identify themselves as a Palestinian. Today, there's 21% of the population in Israel are Arab, and every family has a history or a memory of the Nakba. And some define themselves only as a Palestinians. And this definition is a political and also express the connection to the story of the Nakba and to the history of this place and to the families. And it's worth noting that Palestinians or Arabs who remained in Israel, all of them received the Israeli citizenship, whether they want or not. And some of them define of them Israeli Arabs and those who are managed to integrate into Israeli society, and some of them work in Israeli institutions. And there are people that prefer to emphasize the Palestinian identity, which is a part of the family and the history and the Palestinian villages and the history of the previous generation. And you know, Alison, all these definitions only prove one story, that the Nakba has not been forgotten. And there are those still deprived because of what happened in 1948. And the stories and the memories are exist everywhere in the Middle East. You can walk around the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan, Jenin, and even Gaza, and they will tell you about the villages where they displaced from. And I think that the Arabs in Israel also experience this thing.
But your peer group, let's say young professional Palestinian citizens of Israel or Arab Israelis, would you say 50-50 in what they would prefer to be referred to as? Is there a strong preference for Palestinian citizens? I struggle with it as a journalist often in how to refer to people. And is it different for Druze?
I think definitely that the young generation, they prefer to identify themselves as a Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And the more that there's wars and oppression from the Israeli regime, they would like to emphasize the connection to the Palestinian issue and the Palestinian history.
So let's move on to our next question. It comes from Krasimir Kanev in Bulgaria.
Hi, I'm Krasimir, a human rights defender from Bulgaria. I want to ask about the access of journalists or other independent observers to what happens in Gaza these days. How can you, as journalists or any other independent observer, get access to information? What are the sources, how reliable they are, and how can you corroborate the information you get?
Every journalist who lives outside of Gaza has his sources, and mainly people he knows personally, and even professionals. And it's not the relationship that begins with the beginning of the war, but is built over the years. Some of my sources as a journalist in Gaza, I met in the past, people who did have the opportunity to leave Gaza for studies or conferences. And there are also professional sources like the Red Crescent that publish almost daily information about the conditions of the wounded and the areas of the explosions. And I think in the case of Gaza, knowing and understanding the Arabic language is very important and crucial, because there are sources that communicate with the Palestinian news agency, Wafa, which is very reliable source of information. And of course, I have also direct contact with journalists in Gaza. It's very important. Even all of them prefer to remain anonymous, but we can verify details with Gazan journalists and photojournalists who are physically there in the real time. Another important source is a direct connection with a human rights organization here in Israel, B'Tselem, because they have investigators in Gaza, and sometimes there are details that I verify with them. And also, of course, the UN organizations that have also workers and data that related to hunger situation and the disease and the health crisis there. And, you know, there's no doubt that there are many challenges, especially when there's internet disconnection. Sometimes it takes days for a message to be answered. And in the military invasions, there are also the Gazans are afraid to answer or to talk via the phone. There's a lot of fear among Palestinians in Gaza, and it's very understandable to talk to Israeli media. I would like to share my experience in the last article I published in Haaretz about the 30,000 people who killed during the war, and looking for information and trying to verify the information just broke my heart, really. I talked to people who lost their relatives and described the process of finding bodies under the rebels, and it was very difficult for me mentally because it reflects the human suffering and the meaning of injustice. I'm trying not to be emotionally, but Gaza is a sad place, and I think the world does not see all this suffering. There was a list of the dead people published in Arabic, and includes two pages, names, the families, and the ages of kids with the ID cards. And I read the lists, names after name, and I was really painful because there's no end for death in Gaza, and the world just watching. You know, it's not just about information. I realize hard stories and painful stories. And it's not just a war between Israel and Gaza. It's a deep crisis in what it means to be a moral person and a human being. You know, the stories of the Gazan people remembered me also with the stories of the Syrian refugees that I met, some of them, and the suffering when people lose everything and they have nothing, just lose everything, lost relatives and friends, and the death is everywhere in Gaza. So sometimes it's very hard for me also as a journalist, because I'm in the end a human being, and sometimes I don't have opportunity to share my feelings for the Israeli readers I'm covering professionally. But it's a sad story that the death in Gaza is everywhere, and people in all the world, and including Israel, they not really understand the huge crisis that's happening now in Gaza.
That leads us right into the next question. Many subscribers were curious about feelings, public opinion, the existence or lack of empathy, both in Israel and Gaza. So on the Israeli side, a subscriber named Vicky Plevin asked us,
"My name is Vicky from Albuquerque, New Mexico. My question is, do a majority of Israelis support the continuation of killing civilians and blocking food and medicine from Gaza?"
And expanding on that, another subscriber, Miriam Moss, writing from Leeds in the United Kingdom, said she was very disturbed to hear that Israeli Jews are not expressing enough horror at what is playing out in Gaza. And she wanted to know if you think that there are ways to cultivate more empathy on the Israeli side towards what's happening in Gaza.
Let's be clear. Actually, I would like to ask a question, and we don't have answer. What do the Israelis know about Gaza? Even before the October 7, Netanyahu's regime managed to make Israelis forget about Gaza issue. So Gaza is not exist in the consciousness of Israelis. They don't know anything about Gazans. It's like another planet. And I'm saying that because it's important to understand the context. Even before October 7, the Israeli people didn't know anything about Gaza. And this is a deep level of dehumanization of the Palestinians in Gaza. And the terror attack of October 7th happened, and Gaza was suddenly in the headlines of the news in Israel. And October 7 deepened the dehumanization of Palestinians in Gaza. You know, the Israeli media, without exception, almost doesn't bring the stories from Gaza, and they does not describe the humanitarian situation and the struggling of Gaza. So the Israelis don't know about anything, not hunger, and they don't understand what's the meaning of collapse the health system in Gaza. So what do you expect? Most of the people in Israel justifying the war, and they really don't, they prefer not to know what's happening in Gaza right now. And I'm telling you that because also from my personal experience, when I publish pieces about Gaza, I get responses, and some of the messages are they telling me, "We are not interested as Israelis to know about Gaza. Let them die. You go to Gaza." So I ask myself, what kind of society we have?
On the other side of that question, how Gazans feel, Alexandro Alter, a subscriber from Mexico, asked you, does the Gazan population support Hamas? Do they really want to have peace with Israel? I mean, in this terrible situation, what do you hear from the Gazan side?
I think it's important to describe what was before. Before October 7, because since 2007, when Hamas won the election and controlled Gaza, the whole Gaza Strip has changed in many ways. And Hamas values is based in very radical anti-Israeli, we can say. And they succeeded to instill these values among the Palestinians in Gaza. And it happened over years, not between day and night. But in the recent weeks, the deeper I go into Gazan discourses, the more I realize that there are also disagreements of about Hamas and supporting Hamas. And it happened before in the past. In 2019, young Palestinians, they tried to go and to demonstrate against Hamas government, and some of them were arrested and imprisoned. So the story here is not just about supporting Hamas or they want peace. The story here is how much Hamas has really succeeded in dehumanization of Jews and convincing Palestinians in Gaza that Israel has no right to exist. I just talked to a friend from Gaza, and he told me our problem is with Israel and not with Hamas. And this reflects how young people see Hamas as a legitimate government. And he told me about the two-state solution. He asked me, will Israel stop building settlements? And I asked him, will the Palestinians also will recognize the state of Israel as a legitimate state? And, you know, this is the essence of the conflict, I think. In the current war, the opinions are more radical, both sides, and without any real intention to find solution. It's very sad.
So our next kind of related question comes from a subscriber named Jack Ruskies. He asks,
why have Israeli Arab leaders remained conspicuously silent in failing to condemn Hamas for the atrocities committed on October the 7th? And as a corollary, why do they continue to remain silent, along with almost the entire world, about the plight of the Israeli hostages who continue to be tortured and sexually assaulted, while focusing only on the plight of the Gaza civilians in the war?
That's kind of general. He says all Israeli Arab leaders have been silent, but I don't know if that's true, is it?
This is an excellent question and only emphasizes that during war, Arabs in Israel immediately become suspicious. And first of all, it's important to mention that the member of Knesset, Mansour Abbas, a head of Ram party, was the first politician that condemned Hamas. And just he did it the day after October 7. And not only that, he added that what happened October 7 does not reflect the values of Islam. And he called on Hamas to release the hostages. And it's important to mention that the experience of October 7 among Arabs in Israel is, I think, underrepresented in the Israeli media. Arabs on October 7 were shocked, really. They live here in Israel, work with Jews, and they really, really was shocked. A friend of mine from the Arab society, he explained the situation. He said, I feel like an orphan without father and without mother, because on the one hand, there's no responsible leadership in the Arab society to speak out. Just Mansour Abbas and Ahmed Tibi and Ayman Oudi. And on the other hand, the Israeli government turns its back on us and doesn't care what happens to Arabs. And I should say that Arabs also were affected on October 7. Their Arabs murdered by Hamas. The story of Awad Darawshi, a paramedic who worked in the Ra'im music festival and provided help for the wounded people there. And he was shot to death by Hamas terrorists. And the tragic story of Suhai Brazim, he's from Jerusalem, and we can see him in the video asking Hamas members not to kill him. He told him, I'm a Muslim, I'm from Jerusalem, and please don't kill me. But that didn't help either. And they killed him. His body was found only after 12 days. And it's very easy to judge Arab society from outside, people who are not familiar in the complicated situation. But the Arab society in collective trauma, even before the war, because also there's incidents of crime and violence that reached their peak last year in Arab society. Almost 250 people were murdered and very few cases have been solved. So there's a real sense of fear among Arabs to speak and to express themselves. And I think, in my opinion, Mansour Abbas really brings a perspective of integration. In fact, he was also in the coalition, and we need more brave people like him.
A subscriber named Craig Blakely asks this question.
Has the war in Gaza changed the treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank by settlers and the IDF? If so, how did it change?
There's no doubt that when all the focus on Gaza, terrible things happen in the West Bank. In my opinion, the situation in West Bank is like a ticking bomb, and not only because the settlers and the IDF. I would like to bring another perspective about what's happening in the refugee camps in the West Bank. The young Palestinian generation, especially the young people who live in the refugee camps, such Jenin refugee camp, have no future and hope. And they understand it well. The Palestinian Authority also has no real control over him. They have no opportunities to work. Some of them worked until the beginning of the war in Israel, and after October 7, there's a collective punishment for all the Palestinians in the West Bank, so they're not permitted to come back to work in Israel. And even moving from place to place in the West Bank is very hard because there are a lot of checkpoints. On the one hand, there's oppression from the occupation, the IDF, and the violence of the settlers toward them. And the other hand, they are young people and they have no future. And the story here is not just how the war in Gaza changed the treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank. We should ask also how Israel will deal with the settlements after the war. There is a continued construction and taking over the Palestinians' lands in the West Bank, such as the Masafer Yatta, and it's a very significant obstacle that will not allow any hope for peace or future for Palestinians and also for Israeli who live in Israel, not in the settlements. And we see also how the Netanyahu government allocates more budgets to settlements. We see Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and all the far-right members of Knesset that deepen the problem by their statements and the supporting the settlers and the settlements.
On a slightly different note, Anna Violante, a subscriber from Milan, Italy, has some questions about coexistence, shared society, kind of related to education and everyday interactions in Israel. She wants to know if there are a lot of bilingual schools in Israel. Do many Arab children go to Jewish schools? Is curriculum part of the school system? Do the individual principals and teachers choose it? And she wants to know if it's easy or hard for ordinary women belonging to the two different communities to make friends on a casual basis, neighbors on the playground, et cetera. And similar questions are asked by a subscriber named Sandy, who wanted to know if Arab Jewish groups in Israel are having any kind of positive impact, bringing people together and supporting each other in these difficult times. And on a personal note, as a Druze woman in Israel, she wants to know where and how do you feel you receive the most support from your Jewish neighbors?
Wow, lots of questions. There are five bilingual schools that belong to Yad Association in Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and in the Galil and Wadi Ara. I studied in an elementary school in a village, and then I studied in Carmel, an Israeli school. And as a woman, it's a different experience. As a teenager, I have also questions. What happens when Arab woman falls in love with a Jewish man? In the Arab society, when you're a woman, there's different, they treat you different. It's more conservative toward women. Talking about Arabs and Jews, their parents are interested that their children to be integrated in the Israeli society, and knowing the Hebrew language and the Israeli culture is crucial and very important to integrate. I'm telling that from my personal experience. But on the other hand, it's very difficult because you're living between two worlds, and it's kind of struggling either as a woman, either against the conservative Arab society and norms, and also the Israeli society in the schools. They perceived you as a minority.
And what about your interactions with your Jewish friends and neighbors? At what moments do you find support from the people that you live around you in Israel in regard to the situation in Gaza? Do you feel alone and unsupported, or are there moments where you do feel support from your Jewish friends and neighbors in this difficult time?
I would like to share my personal experience because October 7 was very difficult for me in personal level. And I felt that something very precious has been taken from me as Shireen. And I get a lot of support from my friends, Jewish friends, and from Haaretz, the people I worked with, they supported me. After October 7, I arrived to Tel Aviv for the Haaretz office. And I cried there. I was very sad about the situation, but I got a lot of support from Haaretz. And for me, this is the meaning of support, understanding the complexity of my reality. And this is the place for me. I feel safe to say whatever I think, and I know I will not be judged. I feel like at home. And, you know, it's a difficult question because really October 7 caused a break in relations between Jews and Arabs. And it really depends on the person himself and the quality of the relationship that existed before October 7. About a month ago, we established a conference in Haaretz with collaboration with the New Israeli Fund and the Arab Jewish Center of Haifa University. And I was one of the editors of the conference. And it was planned before the war. And after the war, there was a discussion whether to do it or not. And I remember telling Haaretz team that we will not give up and we will hold the conference because it's important to bring the voices of the Arab people to the Israeli discourse. And in the end, despite the challenges, the conferences succeeded beyond what we expected. Arabs and Jews participated, and there was very interesting discussions there. And it leaves me with some hope that not everything is lost.
Shireen, the next question comes from Stephen Balkin. He's a professor emeritus at Roosevelt University in Chicago. He's concerned about at-risk Gazan children and I guess other at-risk populations. And he wants to know if Arab Muslims, Arab Christians within Israel, in the West Bank, Jordan, even in the wider Gulf area, United Arab Emirates, could participate in taking in Gazan children at high risk to violence and injury, or maybe they're also their elderly relatives, mothers, sick and disabled people. He wants to know if there's any will or interest in taking in these vulnerable populations. And I'm wondering if there would be any way to do an operation, a kinder transport, if you will, to help Gazan children without it looking like some form of expulsion from Gaza.
It's a popular question in the Arab world discourse. Arab countries, Jordan, Lebanon, and even Kuwait accepted Palestinian refugees in 1948. And to this day, these refugees camps exist and there's bad living conditions and they're crowding and low social status and poverty. And they face difficulty to integrate in the countries. So I'm not sure that the countries are now interested to make it this again. Even though that there is a vulnerable people, unfortunately, there are also double standards in Arab countries. In the one hand, they say they're supporting the Palestinians. And on the other hand, they refuse to accept Palestinians. For example, Egypt. And another thing, the Arab world is also, there's a fear to take Palestinians as refugees because it will be perceived as expulsion and it will not be understood. So I think also that there's different priorities in the Arab world that change, especially in the Arab Gulf, Saudi Arabia and UAE. And they want just keeping maintaining political stability, because the civil war in Syria was very difficult, and millions of refugees left for the Arab countries, and it created a deep crisis in the countries themselves, especially Lebanon and Jordan, so, and also economic difficulties. So they're trying not to think about that as an option to take Palestinians. But recently, I see many applications from young Gazans, young families asking for mass funding so they can leave Gaza. They need money and they need country to accept them because they understand there is no future. But again, there's difference between Syrian refugees who were taken by Arab countries in the Arab world and also Europe and USA. But the Palestinians, it doesn't happen. This is a human tragedy in itself.
Shireen, I'm going to close with a question that sounds really challenging. It's from a subscriber named Roseanne Island, and honestly, I don't know if I could answer it. Her question puts a lot of power into your hands. She wants to know if you, Shireen Falah Saab, if you could create the change needed for Palestinian Gazans and Israeli citizens of all types to coexist, what would you want to see happen? How would you move coexistence forward, and how would you try to create the groundwork that needs to be done in order to help resolve these endless conflicts and the cycle of violence?
I will share you my feelings. I think this is the good answer, that day by day I fear that I have lost the hope, really. I believe that there are good people in Gaza and in Israel that want to live together, and they mean it. And I recorded this podcast because I want people to know that we really need them to understand the complexity of the situation, and things are not black and white. Everyone listening to me now, I want them to know that even boycotting Israel will not help. Changing the situation will start here from Israel and from the Israeli people and the Arab people who live here. And by strengthening the moderate voices, both Israelis and Palestinians, because there are also people who want peace and want solving the conflict. And really, we have to see the complicated situation and to understand that it's a historical conflict, and we need also a politicians that really want to solve this conflict from the both sides, Palestinian and also Israeli.
Shireen, these were really difficult questions, and you have tackled all of them really, really well. I can't thank you enough for agreeing to do this and coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you a lot.
And that wraps things up for the Haaretz podcast. As I said, in coming months, we will have two more podcasts planned in which our subscribers will be invited to submit their questions for a guest journalist. Thanks to my guests this time around, Shireen Falah Saab, to my producer, Avri Rosensvi, and editor, Nara Malkin. I'm Allison Kaplan-Summer, and until next week, shalom from Tel Aviv.